Iran's foreign minister stresses Tehran will never settle for a temporary or limited agreement to revive the JCPOA. A new poll shows a majority of Israelis believe that the regime is on the verge of economic, social, and political collapse. And the death toll from Hawaii wildfires rises to 96, with hundreds of people still missing amid growing anger over the response to the deadliest U.S. blaze in a century. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story this hour takes us right here to Iran. Iran says it is committed to resolving the 2015 deal through diplomacy, but it will not settle for a temporary or limited agreement. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, made the comment in a televised press conference. He added that Tehran has always wanted to return all parties to full compliance with the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Amir Abdullahian said that removing Washington's unilateral and unfair sanctions through diplomacy has always been on the government's agenda. On the unblocking of Iranian assets in South Korea and a prisoner swap with the U.S., he stressed that there are two independent and unrelated issues.
The Iranian funds in South Korea are unfrozen and given back to the Islamic Republic, which is our right. The prisoner swap is completely a humanitarian issue, and we do not consider any connection between that and the unfreezing of our assets.
He added that with the mediation of a third country, Tehran and Washington held separate meetings regarding the prisoner swap and the unfreezing of Iranian assets. The top diplomat said the assets were transferred from South Korean banks to a European bank. Billions of dollars was illegally frozen by Seoul for several years as a result of U.S. sanctions. Tehran strongly condemns Sunday's terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz, saying terrorists are trying to retaliate for the heavy blows Iran dealt to them. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said terrorists target innocent civilians out of anger over their humiliating defeats. Kanani also highlighted as decisive the role of the late Iranian commander, General Qasem Soleimani, in the fight against Daesh terrorists in Israel. Earlier, President Ebrahim Raisi ordered an immediate probe into the deadly terrorist attack, which left at least one person dead and several others wounded, some critically. A gunman opened fire at an entrance of the Shah Charak Shrine on Sunday. The assailant was arrested at the site. Security forces have also detained eight other suspects for the shooting. A political analyst, Hakim Issaghi Ibiria, says the legacy of the late Iranian commander and the national hero in the fight against terror, General Qasem Soleimani, lives on despite his martyrdom.
So when we say martyr Qasem Soleimani, you know, religiously we believe that he is living. He's not dead. And we see that in the you know, in the continuation of his thought, in the continuation of the sincerity that, you know, the people who are following his footsteps, the security forces, and, you know, the people fighting terrorism on Iran's behalf, and in the region, you know, in the resistance front, we see the continuation of his life, actually, that, you know, he's living, he's not dead. Of course, I was saying that, you know, this has been an ongoing fight, that every once in a while we hear news of, you know, plots that have been found out and, you know, haven't been able to actually actualize. We have had several of those sort of plots in the last couple of months, you know, between the time of the last Shah Charak terrorist attack and today. And sometimes that doesn't get as much news coverage as, you know, it should.
Well, in Israel, months of violent protests against a highly controversial judicial overhaul plan have led to severe internal crisis. A new poll shows the majority of Israelis believe that the regime is on the brink of an economic, social, and political collapse. Now, the poll conducted by an Israeli institute suggests that over 58% of people believe that the regime has entered a state of emergency. This following last month's passage of a bill that would see the highest court stripped of most of its powers. Now, the poll also shows that the majority of Israelis have lost faith in the future, with nearly one-third of them considering leaving the occupied territories. The planned judicial overhaul, which was proposed in January, has sparked massive protests and criticism, both at home and abroad. Well, Lebanon is marking the 17th anniversary of Hezbollah's victory over Israeli forces in the 33-day war. The Tel Aviv regime's air and ground invasion triggered a strong response by the resistance movement. Well, the war ended following UN-brokered ceasefire that not only put an end to a confrontation between the Israeli army and the resistance forces, but also ushered in a new era for Hezbollah's achievements. Our correspondent in southern Lebanon, Mariam Saleh, explains.
That was the time when the Israelis basically were not only defeated, they did not accomplish any of their objectives during that time. And August 14th, you saw hundreds, maybe thousands of people who were from South Lebanon. They came back to their homes even on the same day, just an hour after the ceasefire on August 14th at 8 a.m. when the Israeli hostilities stopped. And then the Israelis were still pulling up their tanks from some areas at the border. We had thousands of people packed up, ready to return to their destroyed homes, despite the fact that there were no roads, there were no bridges. People were stopping their cars, walking for long distances or waiting for in their cars for hours until there was some sort of a road that the army had opened in order for them to return. We saw these images with our own eyes. So therefore, this did not just signal the end of a war or the end of a confrontation between the Islamic Resistance, the Hezbollah, and the Israeli army, which is something that people before the year 2000 were used to. They were used to this continuous confrontation. However, what we saw was actually a new phase. The Israelis, in addition to not accomplishing any of their objectives, they were not able to defeat Hezbollah. Hezbollah's arms are still intact. Hezbollah's power is still intact. They are gaining strength, gaining momentum. Hussein Nasrallah has said on and on that they have more than 10,000 rockets. He said this after the year 2006, so now it might be even more than maybe tens of thousands of rockets, perhaps. So we have that gaining strength for the resistance, and at the same time, you have more support for Hezbollah. And also with the Israelis, you have more investigations against this war. The fact that it was a failure, the fact that whether the military leadership or the political leadership, they were even at odds with each other. They were blaming each other on what has happened in the war. The fact that they did not have any strategy that was successful. They tried the Air Force. Then after what the Air Force could not do, they tried to do on the ground. That, too, was a failure.
Well, Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip were left with seriously contaminated water due to years of Israeli blockade and multiple military attacks. Ashraf Shannon brings us more.
Groundwater pollution has reached an alarming level in the Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants, posing grave risks for Gazans. Israel has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewage systems and targeted them during wars. Water pollution poses serious health risks throughout the tiny coastal sliver.
The Israeli continuous blockade has severe implications on the situation of water in Gaza. 97% of the Gaza aquifer water is polluted due to the destruction happened on the last offensives that we witnessed in Gaza Strip.
More than 2 million Gazans are forced to buy filtered water in order to cook or drink. Tap water in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. People only use it for house cleaning and doing the laundry.
Tap water is not suitable for drinking, and I think it's not even good for animals to drink. Tap water makes us sick, and we only use it to wash our clothes and to clean the house. My family spends a lot of money to buy filtered water. We only use filtered water to cook and drink.
Inhumane Israeli practices have taken their toll on the coastal sliver's drinking water. Water contamination levels are at least three times higher than the standards of the World Health Organization for safe drinking water. The consumption of contaminated water at levels over international safety standards can cause potentially life-threatening diseases.
Years of Israeli siege and multiple wars since 2008 have devastated Gaza's water infrastructure and led to increasing levels of pollution in drinking water supplies. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Moving now to Afghanistan, where a blast has rocked a hotel in the southeastern province of Khost. Local media says at least three people have been killed and seven others injured. So far, there's no claim of responsibility. We're earlier joined by Rahmatullah Bakhbad, who gave us more details.
An explosion took place in a hotel in southeastern Khost province of Afghanistan. The hotel is supposed to be affected by Wazir Sunni displaced people or Wazir Sunni refugees on Khost province. Local people. Local reporters say that the victims are taken to the hospital and the Taliban forces have taken full control of the area and have a heavy presence here. However, it's not clear that who or what is behind the blast. The motive or nature of the attack is not announced yet as well. But there are some rumors, especially by Pakistani media or reporters that it is hit by Pakistani rocket because in that hotel PTP members were located, but it's not officially announced any of either Taliban in Afghanistan or Pakistani government.
Moving on to other news, turning to the United States, where the death toll from the wildfires in Hawaii has risen to 96 amid growing anger over the response to the deadliest U.S. blaze in 100 years. Hawaiian authorities say the number of fatalities will increase further as hundreds of people are still unaccounted for. The fire has damaged or destroyed more than 2,200 structures in the hardest hit town of Lahaina. It has also left thousands homeless. Officials have launched an investigation into the handling of the fire, as residents are complaining that there were no warnings. Hawaii Congresswoman Jill Tokuda says officials had underestimated the danger of the devastating fire. The blaze has been described as the worst natural disaster in the island's history. And the UK is once again the scene of another strike action, this time by junior doctors who are locked in disputes with the government over pay. The doctors are calling for a 35% rise in their wages, but the government has only proposed one-fourth of that amount, making dismal the prospects of finding a resolution to the crisis.
The United Kingdom is hit with yet another strike action as junior doctors have launched a new walkout amid continued disputes with the government over pay and working conditions. The four-day strike began on Friday and continues until Tuesday. It includes actions by doctors just days into the medical practice. Doctors say their walkout has reached its tipping point due to the government's failure to deliver on its promises. The junior doctors demand a 35% rise, but the government says that is unrealistic and not negotiable. It is proposing a fourth of what junior doctors are asking for. The action is set to impact tens of millions of people receiving services from the National Health Service or NHS. The walkout could push only the number of appointments cancelled due to the NHS strikes past 1 million.
Pay us or lose us!
Save our NHS!
Save our NHS!
NHS officials have warned of massive disruptions as a result of the strike action taken by the junior doctors.
This latest round of junior doctors' strikes will again significantly disrupt services for patients. The additional changes this time is that organizations are unable to use agency workers to cover staff out on a strike. It is also a period of time where NHS staff often take annual leave, so there are already gaps in the workplace.
The comments by Dr. Powis comes as the number of people on waiting lists for treatment has surged to a record 7.6 million. In the past months,
UK nurses, ambulance staff, and other medical workers have all joined industrial action across the NHS, mounting more pressure on the government to address the economic woes and financial stress on the public health service workers.
Well, the UK has been hit by similar actions by workers from other public and private sectors over the past year, at a time when Britain is dealing with issues such as housing, soaring food prices, and chronic energy shortages. One wonders if the government of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak will be able to survive.
The four-day stoppage by junior doctors, come as the British Medical Association, or BMA, which represents strikers, says the take-home pay of junior doctors has plunged by 26% in the last 15 years. BMA says it will continue to campaign for better pays for its members after branding the public sector pay rise announced by the government in July as insufficient. UK Health Minister Steve Barclay has remained defiant to the junior doctors' request for increased pay. Barclay insists that the pay increase is sufficient and has urged the BMA to end its strikes immediately. Barclay says the pay rise of 6% announced by the government is final. This comes as Britain has been hit hard by similar such action for the past year, with NHS staff being among the main government employees calling for higher wages and better working conditions. The most recent one was a strike staged by senior doctors on July 20 and 21. The British Medical Association said senior doctors will stage another two-day walkout on August 24th and 25th, with the industrial action expected to put the country's National Health Service under more strain. The back-to-back walkouts have already taken their toll on the country's healthcare system, prompting fears for patients' safety. Not only that, the unprecedented cost of living crisis in the UK has already impacted the Brits hard. Just to mention a few examples, an umbrella group has warned that London's housing crisis is becoming unmanageable, as 1 in 50 Londoners are now living in temporary accommodation. The group has urged the government to help low-income families. In the case of food prices, the cost of some basic items such as cheese, butter, and bread has soared to more than 30% in the last 2 years, forcing poorer households to make desperate choices between keeping up with their bill payments or putting food on the table. But those are just tip of the iceberg, as the government of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is dealing with a huge economic paralysis. From raising of interest rates to curb inflation and its subsequent impact on the UK households, to a large portion of the British population being at a breaking point in dealing with their economic situation, it is not clear what lies ahead in the future for the Brits. Maybe a change in government economic policies can act as a short-term remedy to bring an end to the crisis in the UK.
And with that, brings us to the end of this World News edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. With the UK military seeing 30% decline in regular forces recruits, the country has resorted to review its recruitment policies to allow it to access a wider pool of people, including those suffering from certain neurological conditions like autism. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Financial Times, the British military could review its recruitment policies to allow it to access a wider pool of people, including those suffering from certain neurological conditions. Morrison, who serves as Parliamentary Under Secretary of State for Defence People, Veterans and Service Families, argued that this would help provide the armed forces with the skilled professionals amid chronic staffing shortages. In an interview with Financial Times published recently, Morrison explained that there are pinch points where things are quite serious, adding that the UK military should adopt a more flexible approach toward hiring new personnel. The MP stated that with the armed forces placing increasing emphasis on cyber warfare, it should start casting the net more widely to hire neurodiverse people. According to Morrison, while personnel with dyslexia and dyspraxia are already serving in the British military, the door should now be open to candidates with autism, Asperger's, and ADHD. These people may possess skills and attributes which others don't, the lawmaker argued. Morrison also suggested allowing older personnel to continue serving for longer, as there is no philosophical barrier as to why we couldn't look at extending the age of retirement. In June, a government-commissioned analysis revealed that the British military was failing to attract technologically skilled recruits. The NATO Deputy Supreme Allied Commander for Europe, General Tim Radford, also warned last month that London could cease to be a major power within the US-led bloc, as its military is too small. Speaking to the Daily Telegraph, the commander stressed that the modern technology which Britain is betting on cannot fully replace traditional armed forces. Last month, a survey of British military personnel conducted between September 2022 and February 2023 indicated that only 42% of troops were satisfied with service life. Among the main grievances highlighted by the poll were poor housing conditions and low wages. Commenting on the state of affairs in the British military, Defence Secretary Ben Wallace acknowledged back in January that it was hollowed out and underfunded. According to the website of Army Technology, newly released figures show near total reductions across the board for the UK military as recruitment and retention rates fall amid a worsening economic decline. The strength of the UK armed forces dropped by 3.3% between October 1, 2021 and October 2022. According to the latest recruitment and retention figures released by the UK government, with just 5,090 people joining the regular forces, a 29.8% decrease registered during the reported period. Releasing the quarterly service personnel statistics on December 15th, the UK government revealed that the total strength of UK forces personnel stood at 192,300 as of October 1st, 2022. This marked a 6,640 decrease in service personnel compared to the same point last year. Further decreases were registered in the full-time trained strength of the Royal Navy, Royal Marines and Royal Air Force, RAF, and the full-time trained strength of the British Army on October 1, 2022, with the figure standing at 134,940, a decrease of 2,190 or 1.6% from October 1, 2021. Recruitment has also registered a steep drop, with 11,982 people joining the UK regular forces in the past 12 months, that is, between October 1, 2021 to September 30, 2022, a decrease of 5,090, that is 29.8%, compared with the previous 12-month period. Tellingly, retention is also suffering, with 16,250 people leaving the UK regular forces between October 1, 2021 and September 30, 2022, or more than 1,300 per month, an increase of 2,400, that is 17.4% compared with the previous 12-month period. Further decreases were registered when comparing the full-time trained strength of the Royal Navy, Royal Marines and RAF, and the full-time trained strength of the British Army at October 1, 2022 of 134,940, a decrease of 2,190, 1.6% from October 1, 2022. Recruitment has also registered a steep drop, with 11,982 people joining the UK regular forces in the past 12 months, a decrease of 5,090 compared with the previous 12-month period.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
Who is fighting Imam al-Hussein? Who is at war with Imam al-Hujjah? I don't want to go over concepts that are not practical, because that doesn't tell us what we're signing up for. That is, again, going to be something that's at least not clear. We want to be very practical, very contemporary. Anyone who takes any measure against Islam is fighting the manifestation of Islam, Imam al-Hujjah and Imam al-Hussein. Anyone who fights Islam. Anyone who takes any measure against Islam. Amir al-Mu'mineen considered anyone who fought the Muslims, who was trying to create, impose a threat for the Muslimin from the outside. The Persian Empire, the Roman Empire, these were the ones that were there. Amir al-Mu'mineen considered them the enemies of Islam. Therefore, them creating and posing a threat for Muslimin. Ali ibn Abi Talib is in Medina. Ali ibn Abi Talib instructs people, including the second Khalifa, who was the accepted ruler at the time. He tells him, this is how you need to do it. Anyone who attacks Muslimin. Okay. Let's look at this, brothers and sisters. Let's look at the conditions that we have. Let's look at the Muslimin. Let's look at Islam. Western rulers have been fighting, besides others, Islam and the Muslimin for, in the recent history, the time that they started making progress and conquest of Muslim lands. In the last 150, close to 200 years, they started going towards Muslim lands. They've been fighting. The British have fought the Muslimin, are fighting the Muslimin. The Portuguese fought Islam and the Muslimin. The Dutch fought Islam and the Muslimin. The French fought Islam and the Muslimin. The Germans did that. Any European power that you see today, all these countries, the ones that are powerful, they have all been fighting Islam at a time where the US was just developing. And then post-Second World War, again, amongst others, the United States government has been fighting Islam and Muslimin on various different levels. Part of it is military combat, military conflict with Muslimin. We may disagree with Muslimin on certain levels and certain beliefs or whatever, but as the Prophet said, anyone from the outside of the Muslimin that attacks any Muslim and calls Ya lal Muslimin, it is the responsibility of the others to respond. And in other words, the one who is involved with aggression with Muslimin of whatever sect and whatever belief, they are fighting Islam and they are fighting Imam al-Hujjah. There's been numerous. They conquered all Muslim lands. Let's not forget that. From the Far East, the Philippines were Muslim lands. Malaysia, Indonesia, Muslim lands. India, Muslim lands. Bangladesh, Muslim lands. Much of that area is Muslim lands. They conquered all of that. Afghanistan, Central Asia, Uzbek, all these different lands, one way or another, whether the Eastern Europeans, Western Europeans, Iran, Iraq, Arabia, Northern Africa, various African countries, East Africa with such a large Muslim population, all conquered. It was war. These are those who are harb with Islam and they are harb with the Imam of our time. When you say إِنِّي حَرْبُ لِمَنْ حَارَبَكُمْ, you're saying, I'm at war with these people. Is this something of the past? No, because it's not only military conflict. Western powers have been depicting, giving the image that reflects their image. They're giving that to Islam. All the deaths that they have created in the past couple of centuries, the slavery that they have created, every wrong thing that they know and they reflect and is their image, they're saying Islam is that. This is a type of war. The reason why an average Westerner would feel bad about seeing a Muslim, seeing a hijabi, an ignorant American would even go so far as using foul language, physically harassing a Muslimah. They're ignorant. The ones who are causing this ignorant person to think that way are the elite in the West. They've been fighting Islam in that way. Economic wars, ideological war, which is the essence of a political war. This is who who they are. This is what harb liman harab. These are the ones that are doing harb of the imam of our time. If you want to sign up for Anis Salmu liman salamakum, if you want to say that in Ziyarat Ashura, you're referring to Abu Abdullah. You address him. You got to see him before you. Ya Abu Abdullah, inni silmun liman salamakum wa harbun liman harabakum. Harbun liman harabakum means these people who are fighting Islam, I am going to fight back. If you don't want it, don't sign up for it. Don't say that. From the beginning, don't say it. Don't say, yeah, I do my... These clothes, this amama is for the battlefield, the ideological battlefield. And it's our kefen. That's what it is. It's prepared. Any point. This is what we sign up for. Inni silmun, we say it. And we ask Imam al-Hussein, if at any point, Ya Abu Abdullah, at any point, it gets to a point where you see, I may abandon you, abandon my post, not fight your enemies, abandon you in that battlefield. Ya Abu Abdullah, take this life. It's not worth living. If it's for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, if it's for Imam al-Hujjah, alhamdulillah, ahla min al-asal. It's the best thing. I don't want this. We don't want this. These are the words of anyone who signs up for inni silmun liman salamakum wa harbun liman harabakum. If any European country decides to tell the Muslimin in that country, you are not allowed to show loyalty to Abu Abdullah al-Hussein by not being able to support the ones who put their lives down for Imam al-Hussein, who shed their blood for Imam al-Hussein, who were killed by the enemies of the Imam in Baghdad, Shaheed Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and Shaheed Haj Qasim Sulaiman. If any European country decides to put that law, that's fighting Islam. That's harb against Islam. You are saying, harbu liman harabakum. I will fight back.
Ya Hussein, ya Habib. Ya Hussein, ya Habib. Ya Hussein, ya Habib.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The UN report on Guantanamo detainees calls on the US regime to not only apologize for its use of torture and provide redress for the victims, but also to make sure they have proper access to health care and rehabilitation, which at the moment they do not. Nobody should hold their breath for the US to do the right thing. It is simply incapable of doing so. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International noted, America is notorious for pointing fingers at others' wrongdoing, but completely denies its own crimes. Consider torture. June 26 was commemorated worldwide as the International Day in Support of Victims of Torture. U.S. President Joe Biden, reflecting customary arrogance, issued a statement saying his regime is committed to eliminating torture and supporting its victims. Really? The glaring hypocrisy in Biden's statement was pointed out by Sarah Gannett, Assistant Federal Public Defender, District of Arizona. She wrote, "While Biden named various countries and entities that have engaged in torture, he failed to name his own country. He did not acknowledge the use of torture against hundreds of people U.S. forces had taken to black sites around the world, dozens of whom remain imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay. America's apologists would protest. The U.S. regime does not do torture. It subjects victims only to enhanced interrogation techniques, they claim. What kinds of exotic techniques the U.S. has indulged in and continues to indulge in will be highlighted shortly. But first, let us consider the report released the same day on June 26th by the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms, Fiona Ní Oláin. Following a visit by a team of UN experts to Guantanamo Bay last February, the first in two decades, they released their support on June 26. It makes grim reading. The detainees, held close to two decades after being seized as suspects following 9/11 attacks, have endured a litany of abuse. These include forced cell extractions, forced feeding with tubes inserted through their nose, in some cases even anal feeding, for what purpose we don't know. The poor medical and mental health care. Family visits are not permitted. Even phone calls to family members are extremely restricted. The same applies to lawyers whose phone conversations are monitored. Ms. Ní Oláin said, "The totality of all of these practices and omissions amounts, in my assessment, to ongoing cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment under international law." Introducing the team's report, Ms. Alon said Washington had yet to address the most glaring rights violation related to the detainees, their secret seizure and transfer called Extraordinary Rendition to Guantanamo in early 2002. Many endured extreme torture at the hands of U.S. operatives in the first years after September 11 attacks. While the Americans coined such fancy phrases as enhanced interrogation techniques and extraordinary rendition, in common language, these meant torture and kidnapping. Let us recall what 780 men that were held at Guantanamo Bay at its peak went through. They were stripped naked, always shackled, held in extremely stressful position for prolonged periods of time, slammed against a concrete wall, subjected to prolonged sleep deprivation, and that most horrible of all tortures, waterboarding. Detainees such as Abu Zubaydah and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed were each waterboarded 83 times in 1 month. They were taken to black sites in Thailand, away from public view and horribly tortured. Abu Zubaydah, a Palestinian but holding Saudi citizenship, was accused of being a senior Al-Qaeda operative. American Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said he was, if not the number two, very close to the number two person in Al-Qaeda. The CIA informed Assistant Attorney General J. Bybee that he served as Osama bin Laden's senior lieutenant. In that capacity, he has managed a network of training camps. He also acted as Al-Qaeda's coordinator of external contacts and foreign communications, the agency alleged. George W. Bush used his case to justify the CIA's enhanced interrogation program, that is torture, claiming that he had run a terrorist camp in Afghanistan where some of the 9/11 hijackers trained and that he helped smuggle Al-Qaeda leaders out of Afghanistan so they would not be captured by U.S. military forces. True, Abu Zubaydah was involved in Khaldan camp in Afghanistan, but it was during the Soviet occupation in 1980s. At that time, the CIA was also actively involved in the Khaldan camp, financing and training the Afghans to fight the Soviets. The Khaldan camp was shut down by Taliban in 2000 because serious differences had emerged with Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Some American writers now admit that Abu Zubaydah had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, including Kevin Ryan writing in the Foreign Policy Journal and Rebecca Gordon in Counterpunch. Ryan revealed that in September 29, the U.S. government admitted that Abu Zubaydah was never a member or associate of Al-Qaeda at all. Rebecca Gordon was even forthright in her dismissal of U.S. allegations against Abu Zubaydah. She wrote in Counterpart, "None of it was true. American officials lied through their teeth to justify their crimes against Abu Zubaydah and many other innocent people." The CIA hired two contractors, the psychologists Bruce Jessen and James Mitchell, to work on Abu Zubaydah. Their mission was to induce what they called learned helplessness, meant to reduce a suspect's resistance to interrogation. They charged $81 million for their services to test their theories about using torture to extract information. Using a plan drawn up by Jessen and Mitchell, Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded 83 times in the course of a single month. Waterboarding involves strapping a victim to a wooden board, placing a cloth over his entire face, and gradually pouring water through the cloth until he begins to choke. At one point during this endless cycle of torture, according to the U.S. Senate Committee report on torture and extraordinary rendition, dated December 9, 2014, Abu Zubaydah became completely unresponsive, with bubbles rising through his open, full mouth. This was the learned helplessness that the psychologists induced in him, but he had no information to give. Even when the FBI concluded that he had no new information to give, the CIA continued to torture him. Dick Cheney, then serving as U.S. Vice President, insisted that torture was working and useful information had been extracted from Abu Zubaydah through torture. In addition to waterboarding, the Senate torture report indicates that Abu Zubaydah was subjected to excruciating stress positions, causing terrible pain without leaving a mark, sleep deprivation for up to 180 hours, which generally induces hallucinations or psychosis, unrelenting exposure to loud noises, another psychosis inducer, walling, the CIA's term for repeatedly slamming the shoulder blades into a flexible, false wall. Though Abu Zubaydah told the International Committee of the Red Cross that when this was first done to him, he was slammed directly against a hard concrete wall, and confinement for hours in a box so cramped that he could not stand up inside it.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on June 11, 2023, in a meeting with a number of scientists, specialists, experts, and officials of Iran's nuclear industry. Over the last 20 years, we have come to realize who is trustworthy and who is not trustworthy. So this was what I had to say about the importance of the nuclear issue. As I said, you probably know these things more than we do, but I want the people to know about these as well. The second issue that I want to outline is about the advancements that have been made in this industry in our country. Of course, I am not an expert in technical matters and don't have enough information in this area to speak about this. It is your job to shed light on these advancements, but I would like to speak about this matter in general. I would like to say one thing about this verse. In our political language, we have words such as mustaz'af, the oppressed or underprivileged, and istaz'af, weakness. We say, for example, such and such nation is mustaz'af nation, or we were a mustaz'af nation before the revolution. The word mustaz'af is a profound, meaningful word.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What is the meaning of mustaz'af? It refers to someone who has been kept weak. Mustaz'af is different from za'if or weak. Za'if means someone who is weak, but mustaz'af is someone who has been kept weak. Being kept weak, which is the meaning of the word mustaz'af, is of two types. There is a time when a world power comes, dominates a country, and keeps it weak. For example, there are colonial powers that kept the colonized countries weak, such as Britain. It kept the countries in the Indian subcontinent weak for so many years. If you refer to the book Glimpses of World History, written Jawaharlal Nehru, the former Prime Minister of India, who was an informed scholarly man, he explains what India was like before the arrival of the British and what happened after their arrival. He explains how India deteriorated, how impoverished it became. This is colonialism. Therefore, one type of istaz'af or weakness is when the world power holds a nation back, which is a bad thing. It is dangerous. What's even more dangerous is the second type of istaz'af, and that is when a nation itself believes that it is weak. When it believes that it is incapable and that it cannot do anything. This is very dangerous.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.